It's 9:30 a.m. on the last morning of the 2010 European AES Convention in London. Welcome to the last of my podcasts from the convention floor. Last night's press events were busy affairs. The cocktails and beers at the Audio Precision stand and, in Merging Technologies' case, the Swiss cheese and chocolates, soon disappeared under a barrage of press and visitors to the exhibition. A large group of representatives from the technical audio press was also treated to a demonstration of PMC's new IB2 XBDA and AML2 monitors upstairs in their dedicated demo room by the company's own special systems group manager Maurice Petist. But sadly, no one from PMC was free for an interview, so I'm hoping to catch up with Maurice or somebody else from PMC later today. I started the final day of the convention with a look at the stand taken by Queen Mary College, University of London, at the back of the exhibition hall. Specifically, the Centre for Digital Music within the Electronic Engineering Department at that college. This was the only stand in the exhibition hall occupied by an academic institution, and they didn't appear to be there just to promote their courses. In fact, it looked as though they were demonstrating products like everybody else in the exhibition hall. It turned out that what was on display here was exactly the sort of thing Josh Rice was talking about being able to see at the AES show on the very first day of the convention. These were not products that you can go out and buy from a music retailer now, but the results of some audio-related academic research, which could be on display as commercial products by the time of next year's AES, or possibly the year after. Of course, Josh Rice, as well as being this year's AES convention chairman, is also a lecturer at Queen Mary's Centre for Digital Music, so that's probably why he mentioned this. To begin with, research assistant Dr. Matthew Davis from the centre explained a piece of software he had developed for detecting rhythm patterns in one piece of audio and mapping them onto another. So what we've got here are two audio files on screen, just to describe it, and you appear to be doing some sort of transformative process between the two. Can you explain a bit more about it?
Yeah, of course. So what we have are a source file and a target file, and we're trying to do a rhythmic mapping from one to the other.
Okay.
So we're analysing rhythmic structure in both signals in terms of musical beats, bar boundaries and rhythmic patterns,
right.
And then we try to learn an automatic mapping that allows us to transform one into the other.
I see.
And then we're generating a way to stretch or squash different regions of the signal in order to implement a rhythm transform.
I see.
So the example we have here, we have a piece of rock music at the top and we have a piece of reggae music at the bottom.
Okay.
So we learn the rock pattern, learn the reggae pattern, and then transform the rock into the reggae. So we have Led Zeppelin playing in the style of Bob Marley.
That's extraordinary, right. So obviously beat detection systems have been around for quite some time now and have got reasonably good as well, but this is clearly going beyond that because you're talking about accent and emphasis being carried across from one file to the other as well, as a pure sense of it keeping in time.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we're not just looking to find beats. This is still a challenging open problem, I would say, that's not been solved. And there are many reasons why it's difficult, mostly due to the fact that people tap to music in different kinds of ways.
Absolutely.
But in order to find the rhythmic patterns correctly, we not only need to know about beats, this only tells us about a kind of tapping pulse.
Sure.
We need to know something about meter, something about higher structure that says,
absolutely,
these are how the beats are grouped into bars. And then once we know about bars, we can say, well, how are the events distributed in each bar? So the shuffle pattern of the kind of reggae thing, this is a long, short, alternating sequence of events which repeats over a bar level. So in order to implement the transform of straight fill to reggae, we need to know about bars, which is a harder problem to solve.
Sure, absolutely. Which from just a series of audio with no MIDI, presumably, is actually a very difficult thing to do. You're trying to impose a scheme on a piece of audio that has no scheme.
Yes, I mean, we have to try and find general cues that we can use to try and apply to as many types of music signals as possible.
Sure.
So a good cue for finding bar boundaries might be chord changes, something like this, or a section change or a drum fill. But
so
not all music has chord changes, but has bar boundaries.
Indeed.
And sometimes there's no drums, so it's a challenging problem that we're working on.
Absolutely. And just to say briefly, is it looking for transients? It's seeking those for rhythmic events, but presumably it's also looking at the overall rhythmic structure. For example, the stresses, you know, would obviously fall on the offbeat in a reggae piece.
Yes, I mean, we have ways to... So reggae is an interesting one because sometimes the analysis system will pick up the offbeat rather than the onbeat.
Right.
So we have a couple of buttons where we can correct this if we want to make some... to correct the modification, I suppose.
Right.
But yes, there's a way to find when the events are happening and how strong some events are than others. And this counts when we come to do the rhythmic mapping.
Sure.
We're looking to prioritise the metrically strong events rather than the weaker ones.
Understood.
These are the ones that really carry the feel of the rhythm.
Right, absolutely. It's very interesting. I wish you best of luck with it.
I hope it
develops into something that we can all use in the future.
Well, hopefully on sale this time next year.
Well, yeah, absolutely. that would be the idea. Excellent. Let's just talk briefly about the other product you've got here. You've got a series of electronic drum pads set up in the corner of your stand. And presumably you've had a drummer on this during the course of the show.
We've had many drummers of extremely varied ability having a go on the system.
I bet some of them could have benefited from having a rhythmic tempo imposed upon them.
Yes, exactly.
But what's the thinking behind that anyway? What's happening here?
Okay, so this system is called Beekeeper and it's an interactive accompaniment system. So the idea is you have a drummer who has a backing track, and rather than be restricted to the timing of the backing track, which is often set by a click track in studios,
sure.
We're looking to give control back to the drummer, so the drummer can control the tempo of the accompaniment to give a kind of more human-like performance.
Sure, sure. That's, again, a fascinating idea, and one that I know has been attempted in the past with, there were systems like the Human Drummer in the 1980s, but they were notoriously unreliable. Hopefully with the sort of fast processing speeds we've got now and decent A to D's and with fast times, you can improve on that.
I think having a powerful computer helps. It means you can do a lot of sophisticated analysis.
Sure.
This system is designed to work within certain constraints, actually. I mean, it can follow tempo, but it can't follow wild changes in tempo.
No, sure. Sure.
And there is an initialization that goes on where the drummer will set the tempo at which they start to play.
I see. So it's like a pre-roll or whatever.
It's a count-in, if you
sure.
like, or it's a push
sure.
in the right
absolutely.
Direction.
Yeah.
I mean, if you imagine when musicians play, they don't just go.
No, absolutely.
There's a count-in.
Somebody always counts in. Absolutely.
Exactly. And this is how this system works.
Sure,
So it can follow smooth changes in tempo. This is the idea, which is enough to allow some expressive.
So a consistent slowing down or speeding up.
Yes, I think so. I mean, what we've found with experiments with professional drummers is they're able to learn its limitations and be able to pull around with it and really get
absolutely.
Some exciting results.
On the other side of the stand for the Centre for Digital Music, Dr. Matthew Davis introduced me to Enrique Perez Gonzalez, who has developed a system for automatic real-time audio mixing. An application that could be invaluable in the field of live concert sound.
Enrique, what's this all about?
Okay, this is called automatic mixing, but it's more like aided mixing. And what we're doing is we take a standard mixing console with functions like gain, polarity switch,
sure.
delay,
pan.
Equalization, panning,
sure.
and faders. And for each one of these sections of the mixer, we develop a tool.
Right.
And the main idea is you get your audio flowing normally in your normal mixer, going out through your stereo system, but at the same time we white cable each input to a computer, let's say so.
Right. Okay.
And the computer is analyzing this audio, and at some point the computer, let's say, finds out channel 7 has a polarity problem, we should invert the switch.
Sure.
And it, through a MIDI cable, let's say, goes to the mixer, and the mixer receives this information, which is please on channel 7 switch the polarity.
Right.
And it will do it. So we can do that for gain or any other parameter.
Any
for
other
example.
Parameters on the mixer.
So
yeah.
for example, for gain, we try to do the analog to digital conversion properly.
Right.
So we try to avoid clipping, for example. So if it clips, it will lower the gain and do
right.
things like that. So it's controlling the hardware in this case.
Sure.
So I can do you different demos. For example, this one that I have here is we recorded a piano
right.
with 8 microphones which are randomly placed, and then after playing this to the mixer, it starts analyzing in real time. Everything is for real time. It was
sure.
designed for live.
Sure.
And then it will find out which one is the microphone which is farthest away from
I
the
see.
Piano.
Okay.
Then it will sync everything to that microphone.
I see.
It will find if there's a polarity problem, and it will switch it. So that's one of the things we do. The other thing we can do, for example, is for the faders.
Yes.
Because what we're trying to do is give you a mix which will be technically correct with any aesthetics into it. We are trying to perceptually map every single fader to have equal loudness.
Right, I see.
So we have a microphone
sure.
which sits on the room.
That's
which
taking
listens,
your reference.
Listens to the SPL, and depending on the SPL that's going on, we'll change the weighting of these loudness curves on the inputs.
I see.
And then these measurements are used for setting up the faders.
Right.
So you'll have a mix which every single child has the same probability of hearing being heard, so without, let's say, loudness masking.
Yes, I see.
And then you can bypass this setting and say, well, channel one, which is the lead vocal, I would like it to be a little bit higher or something
louder
like that.
Or whatever, yeah.
And we do the same thing for panning.
Mm-hmm.
We do similar tool. That tool, for example, takes into account priority.
Right.
If it's more important for me, the guitar, for example, I have to say it's priority one. If for you, the most important thing is the vocal, mm-hmm. then it's priority one.
Right, sure.
So if we have the vocal as highest priority, what the system would do is try to give it the... It has the less probability for being panned.
Mm.
Which basically means it's going to try to keep it centered.
Yes.
All the thing that the system will do is analyze the spectral content of the sino.
Okay.
So you have things which are similarly in spectrum, like let's say two guitars which are playing very similar things.
Okay.
It'll try to pan them separately.
I see.
So that you can actually hear.
So it can identify the similarities in those two
exactly.
performances and then set a pan accordingly. You're
exactly.
Right.
So if you have a stereo source, because it comes from the same instrument, it will
right.
also pan them in stereo.
It will notice the correlation.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And then things like if it's very low frequency, it will try to keep it centered as well.
Sure.
And we do that also for equalization, which is also based on perceptual loudness.
Right.
We try to unmask the instrument so that you make everything as clear as possible.
I see.
And obviously this would be very nice, but the problem is like you cannot just go moving faders automatically
situation sure.
because
sure, absolutely.
You have like feedback and things like that.
Absolutely.
So every single thing you're saying here runs on a framework and a software
right.
which ensures that it doesn't matter what you do, the system won't feedback.
Mm.
In the case of recording, it ensures that you don't go out of the dynamic range of the medium. So you can do very crazy things like boost high frequencies plus 24 dB, for example.
Right. Right.
Which the way it works is like if you would have to do that by hand, the
yeah.
way to do it would be one hand on the equalizer and
sure.
you're boosting
it
and the other one on the fader to
take it down so that it doesn't exceed a threshold.
So
yeah.
this thing is doing it in an automatic manner for you. And
sure.
The idea is that it allows you to do all these aesthetic changes
yes.
without having to think on the technical problems.
I understand. Would it be fair to say then, that this is just the way that it occurs to me just now, just as we invented compressors to take care of the dynamics in a signal and make sure that they are kept under control. This system is trying to do that for not just dynamics, but for example for panning, and it's an automated system in the same way that a compressor regulates gain.
It is kind of the idea, and the idea is like you can turn all these tools simultaneously at the same time.
Yes, I see.
And you'll get a really, really fast rough mix.
Sure.
So it's basically like if you have a festival or something,
sure.
you just go
you
and
want to do it quickly.
Say play. Everybody plays, and then you're ready to open the mixer
sure.
very fast.
Sure.
And then you turn off the system, and
yep.
then you
and then you make your manual
exactly,
adjustments.
Exactly, you adjust
yep.
so that it's like very, very fine.
Understood. But I can see a lot of, as you say, a lot of application for that in live performance. You know, everybody knows when you have a rehearsal or a sound check with the band, they play one way, and then when the audience comes in and the concert starts,
exactly.
they play differently. So
exactly.
it's very difficult.
So this system would help for figuring that out very, very, very fast.
That's fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
It would have been nice to talk about more of the centre's research projects, as several other products in progress were being demonstrated on the stand. But unfortunately, I had to get upstairs quickly to the conference floor of the convention. Towards the end of the morning, I sat in on one of the Platinum Session discussion panels organised by the AES, the APRS and the MPG, which Phil Harding told me about yesterday. I had already missed one session like this on Sunday while in the exhibition hall, which had featured big-name producers like Russ Tietelman, Steve Lipson, John Cohen and John Kelly discussing the creative and commercial processes that go into record production with reference to the projects they've worked on. That session was moderated by Howard Massey, who wrote Behind the Glass, two fascinating books all about the craft of the record producer, featuring extensive interviews with many of the recording industry's big names. Fortunately, on the final morning, Howard Massey returned to chair a second behind-the-glass-style session, this one featuring well-known engineer-producers from both the USA and the UK, such as Chuck Ainley, Andy Bradfield, Phil Harding himself, and George Massenberg. I was determined not to miss this session, and it was fascinating stuff, touching on the role of vintage recording technology in modern productions and the effects of new web-based audio distribution methods on the job of the modern engineer. It's always interesting to hear opinions from those working at the creative cutting edge of the recording industry, and it was a lively, engaging discussion. Shortly after the Platinum Engineer session ended, it was time to make my way into the massive conference hall C3, the venue for the opening ceremonies on the convention's first day, for a very special presentation. George Martin, now Sir George Martin in fact, is one of the most famous producers the music industry has ever known. He nurtured the enormous talents of the Beatles at EMI's Abbey Road Studios in London, taking them from their first album in 1963, which was recorded almost as live in one 12-hour session, to the multi-track heights of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the White Album, and the final album they recorded, which commemorates where they achieved most of this groundbreaking musical work, simply titled Abbey Road. A skilled arranger, musician, technically aware producer, and also very gifted at getting the best from creative people in a recording environment, Sir George is also an absolute gentleman, widely regarded as one of the nicest people ever to work in the audio industry. Early Tuesday afternoon, he was awarded an honorary membership of the AES by a group of AES committee members, including awards chairman Jim Anderson, president Dima De Vries, and executive director Roger Furness. Sir George has always been a bit of a production hero to me, and I could see, judging by the number of Beatles t-shirts in the hall when the presentation was made, that I was far from alone. I didn't expect a typical self-serving, I'd like to thank my manager style awards ceremony acceptance speech from a man like Sir George, and he didn't disappoint. Instead, he proclaimed the award absolutely lovely, but went on to say that rather than producers like him receiving any more awards, he felt it was time that engineers in the recording business received more recognition. He called them the unsung heroes of the business, the vital behind-the-scenes workers who would be at a recording session sometimes many hours before the artist arrives to set everything up and prepare the studio, who would make it all happen for the artist when they arrived and would be around long after they left, clearing up, producing rough mixes, and editing sometimes deep into the night. Of course, directed as these words were to an audience comprised mostly of audio engineers, this touching tribute charmed everyone present, and he received a standing ovation of several minutes at the end of his concise, carefully thought-out speech. For me, it was one of the absolute highlights of the convention. Back in the exhibition hall on the final afternoon, I grabbed a couple of minutes with another one of the companies with an important new product to show the industry. Steinberg, German inventors of the sequencing software Cubase, who were unveiling a significant upgrade to their post-production-orientated digital audio workstation software, Nuendo. Sebastian Rortens, one of Steinberg's Pro Audio Systems engineers, told me more about Nuendo version 5.
Nuendo's obviously been around for a long time, Sebastian, but what's new about version 5?
I think the good news about the new version 5 update is that it's an update especially for post-production people. Sure. So we have a complete integrated ADR taker system with several market tracks and all the inputs and exports you need. We have extended our automation system, so we now have a very intelligent undo system for our automation, including branches and passes. And we also have a complete new video engine. We have a complete new surround panner. We have a new handling for our surround plugins. We have new features for our crossfade editor, so it's basically a large update, especially for people doing feature films, TV post, broadcast. Sure. With this update, we really want to show a direction. We really wanted to show the people, okay, this is the direction we're taking with Nuendo. Also in the future, so this is not the only post-production update, so all future updates from Nuendo will be post-production
oriented.
I mean, it was quite successful for us here, so...
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I wonder whether it was a simple matter of timing that, you know, Nuendo 5 was ready, so this was the good show to show it at. Did it work for you, appearing at AS with Nuendo?
Yeah, it works very well. So we had a lot of people attending at the booth, heading and watched Nuendo 5.
Sure.
And the feedback is quite positive. We also did, before the AS, some private sessions at the Art for Noise post-production studio in Soho.
Yeah.
And we had, like, just invited people to the studio, showed them the new Nuendo 5 on their trailer mixing stage. So
sure.
It was a good week for us.
Thanks very much.
With the exhibition hall beginning to wind down in the late afternoon, there was one company I really wanted to speak to that I hadn't yet managed to interview. PMC, who were running the extra seminar room upstairs mentioned by Graham Boswell on the first day of the show. In the last hour before the exhibition hall closed, I managed to track down Keith Tong, PMC's marketing manager.
So I'm interested that some companies have seen fit to take space in the exhibition hall and also their own dedicated seminar room. So here to talk a bit more about that is Keith Tong from PMC, the Professional Monitors Corporation, and to explain what seminars they've been putting on and also what new products they had here to show in the exhibition hall on their stand. Keith.
Okay, in reverse order, we were showing for the first time in the UK the AML2, which has been an upgraded version of our original no-compromise AML1 two-way monitor. 6.5-inch base unit and a 34mm tweeter. so a reasonable size compact, and we looked at reducing the noise floor dramatically in the crossover network. There's new ICs in there, reduce that dramatically, new power supply, and increase the integrity of the cabinet. So overall, the package, lower noise, lower distortion, and you know, it's got that distinct PMC ultra high resolution, cracking monitor. We also had the world launch of the IB2SA, which is available in two forms. It's a three-way device. Either a master cabinet as a three-way, or a twin cabinet, where you've got an XBD cabinet, obviously not featuring a mid and a tweeter below, which makes it a tower stack.
An XBD, so that sounds a bit like your BB5
indeed.
XBD.
Yeah,
is it a similar kind of model that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a similar configuration whereby it comes in blocks. So if you were to mount it, and you wanted to place the master cabinet and the XBD cabinet side by side, it's ideal. Or you can mount it in a freestanding mode where 99% of the guys in mastering are using it freestanding in a tower. Basically, because then you can move it around the room and fine-tune it. It's a lot easier when it isn't software mounted for that. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it works well. And it contains our new amplifier technology that we developed.
Because these are active,
RB2s. Active. 200 watt tweeter, 200 watt on the mid, and 560 on the bass. And again, 560 on the XBD cabinet. But the XBD cabinet can be used as a standalone 0.1 sub if you're looking for an independent 0.1 sub.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the you don't produce a sub per se, but the XBD is effectively your sub in addition to being the extended bass cabinet.
Indeed.
That's fascinating. And so, you know, that's what's happening on your stand downstairs. You've also got this extensive program happening upstairs of seminars. Graham Boswell, as I mentioned, was talking a little bit about that and about how you want to take your products to end users.
Yep.
You've been on roadshows. You've been very active in that regard. Mm-hmm. Presumably your seminar program here at the AES has been an extension of that.
We got advocates of PMC in prison. We share a lot of customers. A lot of our clients are common, and we've got a lot of like-minded professionals in to talk about high resolution audio. Basically, they're using both PMC and prism. Ronald Prince, Stefan Bock, Tim Young from Metropolis, Graham of course from prism, Crispin from Metropolis, who did a rather interesting talk about how to FUCK up a surround mix, which is rather interesting.
Yeah, I saw the title of that one.
It can easily be done.
Absolutely.
And he showed the pitfalls of that, which is very interesting. Jochen Veit, who's from JV Acoustics. We consider him to be the leading acoustician. That certainly we've been working with projects with him for maybe about 4 or 5 years now, and every single one has turned out phenomenally well, because obviously a loudspeaker's response is very much dependent on the room, and his room design is absolutely phenomenal. So he did a very interesting talk about low frequency and the effects of good and bad, the effects of room on low frequency. Tony Cousins and Nick Davis came in and did a talk about the remastering of Genesis.
The Genesis back catalog.
Back catalog in 5.1, which is very interesting.
Surround versions, right.
Surround versions. Phenomenal. Fantastic attendance for that one.
Excellent.
Packed to the gunnels. And finally, Maurice Batiste, our Specialist Systems Group manager, is currently doing a talk with Peter on the benefits of high resolution monitoring.
Fantastic.
Currently, so it's still going on now. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So overall, has it been a good show for you?
Yeah, it's been a very good show, actually. Yeah. I think we've maximised on the attendance.
Absolutely.
I think we couldn't have done any more. It's been pretty good, actually.
Certainly, I know the conference level of the convention has been very busy throughout the show, so you've obviously benefited from some of that footfall.
Yeah, indeed. We've made contact with old faces, new faces, and certainly from the educational side as well. It's been very beneficial.
Keith Tong there from PMC. Shortly after I spoke to Keith, the 128th AES convention officially closed, and the companies in the exhibition hall began to break down their stands. Although it's now gone 6 o'clock, over an hour after the official closing time, the conference floor is still packed, with three discussion sessions still going on. I'm left in no doubt that the convention has been a great success. I hope you enjoyed my reports and interviews from the show, and that they gave a flavour of the convention if you weren't able to attend in person. Until next time, from the Novotel Convention Centre in London's Hammersmith, goodbye.